Congressman Ryan was born in the community of Janesville, Wisconsin. He is a fifth generation native of Wisconsin, and he is currently serving his fourth term as a member of the U.S. Congress. He is best known, I'm happy to say, as one of the leaders in the fight to reform Social Security by allowing for the expanded use of individual retirement accounts. Now, I don't know whether you use the privatization word. We here have no problem with with that. But, you know, sometimes you have to, you know, do a little bit of a soft sell up there because many members of Congress are not quite as far-thinking as Congressman Ryan. I actually met Congressman Ryan when he was a staffer. I believe it was Senator Bob Kasten some years ago, Senator Kasten's former senator from Wisconsin. He was also a speechwriter for Vice Presidential candidate Jack Kemp and has done many other things. But he's here today to tell us a few things about a few thoughts on Ayn Rand. And so without further ado, Congressman Ryan, by the way, also thank you for helping us secure this beautiful room. You can see that we have filled it with people who want to celebrate the life of Ayn Rand and hear some brief remarks from you. So without further ado, Congressman.
Thank you, Ed. Appreciate it. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Nice to have you here. This looks just like my living room at home, actually. You know, it's beautiful, isn't it? That my constituents here know otherwise. I just want to speak to you a little bit about Ayn Rand and what she meant to me in my life and the fight we're engaged here in Congress. I grew up on Ayn Rand. That's what I tell people. You know, everybody does their soul searching and trying to find out who they are and what they believe, and you learn about yourself. I grew up reading Ayn Rand. And it taught me quite a bit about who I am and what my value systems are and what my beliefs are. It inspired me so much that it's required reading in my office for all my interns and my staff. We start with Atlas Shrugged. People tell me I need to start with Fountainhead, then go to Atlas Shrugged. There's a big debate about that. We go to Fountainhead, but then we move on, and we require Mises and Hayek as well. But the reason I got involved in public service, by and large, if I had to credit one thinker, one person, it would be Ayn Rand. And the fight we are in here, make no mistake about it, is a fight of individualism versus collectivism. In almost every fight we are involved in here on Capitol Hill, whether it's an amendment vote that I'll take later on this afternoon or a big piece of policy we're putting through our Ways and Means Committee, it is a fight that usually comes down to one conflict, individualism versus collectivism. And so when you take a look at where we are today, some would say we're on offense, some would say we're on defense. I'd say it's a little bit of both. And when you look at the 20th century experiment with collectivism, that Ayn Rand, more than anybody else, did such a good job of articulating the pitfalls of statism and collectivism, you can't find another thinker or writer who did a better job of describing and laying out the moral case for capitalism than Ayn Rand. It's so important that we go back to our roots to look at Ayn Rand's vision, her writings, to see what our girding, undergrounding principles are. I always go back to, you know, Francisco D'Anconia's speech at Bill Taggart's wedding on money, you know, when I think about monetary policy, and then I go to the 64-page John Galt speech, you know, on the radio at the end and go back to a lot of other things that she did to try and make sure I can check my premises so that I know that what I'm believing and doing and advancing are square with the key principles of individualism. But when you look at the fight that we're in here in Capitol Hill, it's a tough fight. It's a very important fight. But we need more people on our side to fight this fight. That is why there is no more fight that is more obvious between the differences of these two conflicts than Social Security. Social Security right now is a collectivist system. It's a welfare transfer system. It's a system where, and I always tell my constituents, and none of them usually believe me, you don't have an account with your name on it in the federal government. There isn't a box with your cash in it that's going to come to you when you retire. A lot of people think that. And what's important is if we actually accomplish this goal of personalizing Social Security, personalizing Social Security, think of what we will accomplish. Every worker, every laborer in America will not only be a laborer but a capitalist. They will be an owner of society. They will be an owner and a participant of our free enterprise system, of our capitalist system. I would like to have more people on our team who are owners and believers in the individualist capitalist system than on the other side. And if every worker in this country becomes an owner of real wealth, of seeing the fruits of their labor come and materialize for their benefit, then that's that many more people in America who are not going to listen to the likes of Dick Gephardt and Nancy Pelosi, Ted Kennedy, the collectivist class warfare-breathing demagogues. And so what we have coming now in the beginning of this century is a fight. If you take a look at if we ran government on autopilot, and CBO just came out with a really good report on this, and do nothing, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security will grow so fast and consume so much that the government will consume 26% of our national economy, 26% of our GDP. Historically speaking, government in this country runs at about 18% of GDP. We will consume 26% of GDP if we do nothing. So you have to understand that all they have to do is stop us from succeeding. Autopilot will get them where they want to go. Autopilot will bring more government, more collectivism, more centralized government if we do not succeed in switching these programs and reforming these programs from what some people call a defined benefit system to a defined contribution system, from switching these programs. And this is where I'm talking about healthcare as well, from a third-party or socialist-based system to an individually owned, individually pre-funded, individually directed system. We can do this. We are on offense on a lot of these ideas. I was the principal author of the health savings account law, which was an amendment I brought to the floor and passed in the Medicare bill in the last session of Congress. Health savings accounts, personal accounts for Social Securities, these are the things that put us on offense, that the individual back in the game and break the back of this collectivist philosophy that really pervades 90% of the thinking around here in this town. Is this an easy fight? Absolutely not. It's an easy fight. But if we are going to actually win this, we need to make sure that we're solid on premises, that our principles are well defended. And if we want to go and articulately defend these principles and what they mean to our society, what they mean for the trends that we sent internationally, we have to go back to Ayn Rand, because there is no better place to find the moral case for capitalism and individualism than through Ayn Rand's writings and works. And so that's what it meant to me, and that's what sort of fuels me as I try and move and stumble and stumble in a few areas to try and win these fights. I think if we win a few of these right now, moving healthcare to a consumer-based individualist system, moving Social Security to an individually pre-owned, pre-fund retirement system, just those two things right there will do so much to change the dynamics in this society, will do so much to bring more people onto the side of demanding for accountability and individualism and transparency in government than anything else we can do. So we're trying to focus on the big ticket items to win these things, and the other side knows the stakes are just as high. I wish our side knew the stakes were as high. That's the fear I have right now, which is our side doesn't understand these great consequences. The other side, who are going to do everything they can to defeat and demagogue these efforts, they understand what's at stake. They understand what is happening here. We need to do a better job of not only understanding it, but of articulating it and winning. This is a good chance to win these things. And I just want to say thank you, Ed, for doing this, and thanks for coming. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, yeah.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
I'm going to ask the first question, then we'll go back to you. I just have a very quick one. What are there particular Randian arguments that you find really have resonance on Capitol Hill that when you pull them out, people go, oh, or, things like the sanction of the victim or particular things that you find effective? Because we're always trying to discover what's the most effective ammunition we have in our quiver. In other words, we know that certain arguments might work on certain people, others might work on other people. So we're always looking for where are our strengths that we can go ahead and build on when we make arguments.
I think the victimization argument. I think that the fact that collectivists speak down to people as victims is not only an arrogant thing to do, but it produces poor results. Mm-hmm. So backing up this victimization class that collectivists try to produce, and showing the folks you're trying to convince that this is not only in their best interest, in their worst interest, mm-hmm. that it's not dignifying and it's arrogant. That seems to work. We're trying to recruit a lot of minority legislators to work with us on personal accounts because it's of all things in their best interest. Right now, we're trying to fight party bosses from the Democrats who are really insisting on You know, everybody's towing the line. And so that's the biggest fight. As far as individualism, it's just the results. I mean, just look at the data. Look at the numbers. Look at what we produce. The more liberal your economy is, the more free our economy is, the better we grow and the more we prosper. So we have to use results and we have to use data and evidence, which is clearly on our side to do this and undergirded by these principles. And so that's what I do. But I always try to show how victimhood has gotten them nothing. Mm-hmm. And how freeing people, it produces great results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the way, I used to work for Dick Armey, and yeah. One of the things he used to always say is that one of the things that government could start doing is just treating the citizens with some dignity, which it never does. And so he echoed that theme as well. Okay, I think we have a question back here, and then I'll go there. Let's go real good.
Mr. Ryan, it's just quick and simple. What shall I do? What can I do? How do I get on the team?
Oh, there you go. You got to volunteer.
Yeah, that's fantastic. A young person. what shall you do? What can you do? I get that question all the time. Speak your mind and speak up. Get other people to do so. Put pressure on politicians. Do it through groups. Do it in yourself. Write letters to the editor. Support politicians. Come and demand accountability. And speak your mind and speak through groups and with your own voice. On personal accounts, I really think that is the big fight. If we succeed in getting personal accounts, and if everybody is an owner of their own real wealth, and they see their FICA tax as not this black hole they see on their paycheck, but actually something where the fruits of their labor is going to reward themselves, I do believe that that's going to be a major transformation in our society, which will make it much easier to scrap our tax system and change that to go toward consumer-based health care and those kinds of things. Demand that kind of accountability and speak your mind. And I think there are a lot of groups out there who are really preparing for this. There's a few groups out there right now who are preparing not only a political front, an air war, a radio and phone war, but actually getting individuals to participate in the political process. And that's what I would recommend right now. And that's, you know, this year is going to be a big fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You want to go over here?
Yeah, we'll go over there, back there first.
Congressman, there were a lot of reports coming out of the retreat in West Virginia that a number of Republicans were getting cold feet. Realistically, what do you think is the chance of getting legislation this year that includes some measure of personal accounts? Or is this going to be a long-term fight? And we should have listened to Barry Goldwater in 1950.
Yeah, that's right. I wasn't alive then. but I did listen to him afterwards, you know. First of all, the press loves that story. They just can't wait to get their hands on. I talked to a bunch of, you know, Wall Street Journal and LA Times reporters after that retreat, and that was the question. Were there people with cold feet? We hear there are people with cold feet. It sounds like it's coming apart. You know, that's the story they want to write, and they're looking for any quote they can take out of context to justify the story they've already pre-written in their heads to try and say this thing is doomed. That's not what I saw at West Virginia. What I saw at the Greenbrier with our retreat are people coming in who are nervous. We have people with wobbly knees in our conference, no doubt about that. But they became more strengthened. They became more encouraged at West Virginia. We spent a day and a half talking about this issue, talking about the politics of it, the policy of it, and all the other things. And I believe, and I saw some members of our Congress who've made some statements that, you know, were less than great, sitting there absorbing this information. And what I think we got out of West Virginia was more steel to our resolve. I believe we did more to solidify our conference in doing this. And the quote I usually hear these days, I went to dinner last night with six younger members of Congress, newer people, to try and see what they thought about this. And what I'm hearing is are these vulnerable members of Congress and new people are saying, just make sure we do it. Don't bring us up to the precipice, having voted on something and that, not having it go into law so the other side can define what we did and they can demagogue us. Let's get through this demagoguery. Let's get through this political fire and accomplish it so that in 2006, when we're running for re-election, this will have already been done. Workers will see their accounts materializing, and old people will not have been thrown out on the streets. They'll still be getting their benefits. So if anything, what I experienced in West Virginia was as members learn more about this issue, the better they get on this issue. The third rail analogy applies to the fact that any time Social Security was tinkered in the past, we cut benefits or raised taxes. That was bad politics. Mm-hmm. We're not doing that. We're talking about giving individuals ownership and individual accounts. Benefit changes, if they occur, will not occur for people over the age of 55. We're not going to raise taxes, at least if I have my vote and say, and I think that's true, we're not going to. So I believe the political dynamic is different, and as more members understand how this program works and the mechanics of the reforms, the more resolve they get with this. So I feel like we can get this done this year. Yeah.
By the way, I just want to add real quickly, and I know that the congressman has, I'm sure, said this. Jose Piñera, who helped privatize Social Security in Chile, who also is, by the way, an Ayn Rand fan, Jose points out the moral revolution that occurs with privatization. That is, people in Chile, you know, who thought of themselves as Marxists, suddenly feel that they are owners of property. And, you know, they literally get up and they start reading the Chilean equivalent of the Wall Street Journal. I saw this in my own father, who was a Teamster, a truck driver, and close to his retirement, he started putting money in individual retirement accounts. And so whenever I'd go over and visit him, he'd basically be saying, Ed, look how my stocks are doing. I said, Dad, I can't believe it. You sound like more of a capitalist than I do. It creates a moral revolution of people who actually own property. And Congressman Ryan knows that. And I think that's one of the importance of this kind of movement is that we really change not only the economic dynamics, but the moral dynamics. I think we have time for one very quick question.
Ely had his, Bert, who's done so much good work on the GSEs. Bert,
yes. Everyone knows Bert.
I'm increasingly concerned, I know many others are, about a tendency in the Republican Party, the Congressional Republican Party, to actually try to almost outdo the Democrats with regards to new benefits. The Medicare drug benefit bill last year is a very good example. What concerns do you have about that? What can be done to reverse that trend that has developed in recent years?
There's a lot in the Medicare bill that people just do not know about, Bert. And let me give you another side of the story on the Medicare bill. Number one, we got health savings accounts completely unrestricted in this bill. That was something that 45 of us said, unless it's completely unrestricted, the bill is going down. The problem we were facing with was the president was going to sign the Senate bill, which was a miserable piece of legislation, if this didn't pass the House. So you kind of had this gun to your head kind of a situation. But we got HSAs totally unrestricted. Anybody can have an HSA. They tried to cram down income caps on us on HSAs. We blocked that. Now everybody can have an HSA. Other things that are in this Medicare bill that you need to look at, Bert, are the fact that we are basically, to use Ed's ugly word, we are basically privatizing the system because starting next year, senior citizens will have a choice of private plans from which to choose for all of their benefits. Medicare today is a government monopoly where you have this building right down the street running Medicare, price controlling and rationing care. Starting next year, that building down the street, HHS, has to compete with all these other private providers. The government has to compete with other private providers, and they compete against each other for the seniors' business. So seniors start, for once, having choice. Now, what is the future with Medicare? What do we put in this bill to move this down the road, to prevent this train wreck that we're having on numbers and demographics? Number one, in order for consumers to be well-informed consumers, in order for people to respond to the incentives that they have in an HSA as a consumer, they need information. Under a third-party payment system that we have today, you don't care what things cost because someone else is paying the bills, and you can't really shop around based on price and choice and quality because you're in some closed network. Under HSAs, you need to have information. In this new Medicare law, we've told the hospitals, it's in the law, if you don't release your data on quality, if you don't release your data on price, you're not going to get your money. You're not going to get your full payments. So we have a carrot and stick provisions in this law that release this data that we're now just trying to figure out how to get released to the consumer. So now the consumer, armed with an HSA, can actually get information. What hospital is good? What hospital is bad? What does an MRI actually cost at this place, that place? What doctor's good? What doctor's bad? We've got to get that data out there. The big fight that we have is fighting the providers. The hospitals and the physician groups typically don't want the public to know how good or bad or how expensive they are. We've put that in the Medicare law. That's coming out. So when you take a look at the seeds that have been planted in this Medicare law, there is a situation that we hope will materialize, and we think that this law gives us a great chance of doing it, whereby boomers are coming into retirement with an HSA that has resources in it, so that when they come to retirement, they'll pick among catastrophic plans that are private provided from which to choose for Medicare, and they'll have their HSAs come in underneath that. And so you'll have a consumer-directed system not only for those who are under 65 in America, but for those who are over 65 in America. That is the way to save Medicare, not only from bankrupting the federal government because of its incredible growth, but also to bring this system to a defined contribution, individually driven, consumer-directed healthcare system. All those seeds, all those provisions are in this Medicare law. They just haven't taken effect yet because they have these delayed enactment dates. So it's not the end of the world, as you probably think it is.
Okay. Congressman Ryan, I know, has to get off to a committee meeting, and so I just want to thank him for getting this room for us and for your remarks.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Thanks, Ed. Appreciate it. Thanks.